session number 1009, reel 2.
Mr. Scannell, reel 2.
Yes, I was talking about the sort of first experience of battle, and as I was saying, one of the most memorable and still chilling and nightmarish things is hearing the voices of the wounded who've been badly wounded, and the voices raised in terror and pain. And I can remember one particular sergeant who always seemed to me almost a kind of father figure. I mean, he wasn't that much older, but at that age, I was, what, 20, I suppose. He'd probably be pushing 30, which seemed to me a lot older, and rather tough, leathery kind of man. And he was badly wounded, and hearing his voice sort of sobbing, and in fact, calling for his mother, his mum, you know, seemed to me so, I don't know, demeaning and humiliating and dreadful. I sort of felt a kind of shock that I can't fully understand even now. It's sort of because he'd been reduced to a baby, I suppose.
Almost like witnessing your father crying.
That's right. That sort of thing. Yes, yes. That's the kind of thing. A sort of wrench in the universe, really. It shouldn't happen.
I think we should say that this artillery bombardment you've described was a bombardment before Alamo.
That was the big barrage of our artillery, yes, huge barrage. Well, one of the things that did very much strike me about action, about being in battle, subsequently on reflection, was, and I've talked to other people about this who sort of confirmed this, is when you consider the amount of stuff coming over, you know, in terms of actual shells and mortars and bombs and small arms and the rest of it, when you consider the expenditure of weaponry, how few people are hit. That's what always amazes me. I've been under heavy bombardments of one kind or another, and really very, very few people. You know, you're in sit trench, you get your head down. But it always surprised me, really, that there weren't much heavier casualties when you consider the amount of stuff that was coming over. I'd like to say one thing, and this is in relation to my book, where I deserted after an action at Wadi Akrit, that's much further up in North Africa. Now, I remember in the Marath line, this was just beyond Tripoli, where the 8th Army had got taken Tripoli, and then we moved up to this part. I can't remember the name of the place. We were worked in Tripoli unloading ships for a time. We had supposed to be a rest. It wasn't much of a rest. It was quite hard work, but at least one was out of actual action for a bit. Then we moved up to these positions in facing the Marath line. The Marath line was a sort of fortified line where the Germans were sort of fairly the enemy was, Germans had dug in. And I don't know the sort of strategy, but I gather there was some sort of flanking movement. I think it was the New Zealand division did a sort of flanking movement. The frontal assault on the Marath line was almost impossible to get them out, really, because it was a bit like, you know, the famous Maginot line. It was a bit like that. There was sort of concrete sort of well dug in there. But we did what was called a mock attack on the Marath line, and I, as far as I understand it, it was a feint, you know, it was sort of to attract the attention of the enemy while this, I think it was New Zealand division, did this flanking move, what they call the left hook, apparently, round to get bit. So that's the way they got them out of the Marath line. And this particular attack, although it was called a mock attack, there was nothing mock about it. I mean, that sounds rather cozy. It sounds as if you were doing, that's not the real thing. Well, all it meant was that you did your attack with artillery barrage and the whole lot. You went forward, but you didn't actually, the intention, I think, was simply to distract the enemy, and we didn't actually put in an assault on his positions. We sort of went through the minefields in front of his and dug in. That was the objective, as far as I recall. But the thing was that I was a made company runner for this attack, and to the company commander. I won't give his name because it probably would be wrong. But I mean, I remember the man's name all right. I remember him quite clearly. My job was to stay with him, the company commander, and as company runner would probably be given messages or whatever, say, you know, get over to another platoon, possibly another company in the battalion, I don't know, because it didn't arise. But I was given my orders to stick with this company commander, the captain. So he and I, we got to the minefield, and it's around like school sports day, these things. They actually literally have white tape, so there's a starting point for the attack, which is actually marked out with the white tape. There were tapes through the minefield. These scorpions, these big tanks with flails, go through, chucking up the mine, so that there's a path through the minefield, which again is marked down. The engineers have put these tapes. I mean, the whole thing is ludicrous in that way. And we were going through this minefield, and what happened was our artillery, it was what they call a creeping barrage. So the range is gradually sort of increased as the infantry go in. Well, somehow it went wrong. Either the creeping barrage wasn't creeping fast enough, or we were advancing too quickly or something, because we were under our own 25 pounders. We were, and the German artillery, the 88s, whatever they were coming the other way, in the middle of this minefield, and somehow we'd wandered off the track. And there was also the German machine gun Spandau seemed to have a fixed line on the gap of the minefield, so everything seemed to be coming at us. And I remember sort of just lying down, sort of crouching down, because all this stuff was coming over, and also without warning to us, the artillery centre, it's put smoke down, fired smoke bombs, so there was smoke as well, and this caused a bit of a panic. Somebody thought it was gas. I was shouting, "It's gas!" So it was a generally panicky code, and I was sort of crouching down, sort of just with my head down. The company commander here on my right, and I got my head down, not looking at anything. You know, the stuff is coming over, and all you do, your teeth are chattering, and you're praying, and you're swearing, and so. And I suddenly looked to see how he was getting on. He wasn't there. And he deserted. He'd gone back. He ran away in the middle of an attack. Now, I never knew what happened to him. That's the last I saw of him. We didn't see him again. You know, the thing went on the next day. I can't remember the sort of details, but we sort of survived, and we dug in. We got through the mine and dug in on the other side, and we never saw this captain again. And I remember a long time afterwards, back in England, talking about this, saying to a chap, I said, "Do you remember this captain so-and-so? I wonder what happened to him." He said, "Oh," and this man I was talking to had been wounded in somewhere in North Africa and been sent back to a hospital in a convalescent depot. I think it was in either Alexandria or Cairo. He'd seen this officer. I said, "Well, I wonder what happened to him." He said, "Well, I don't know what happened to him." He said, "But I saw him, and he had a crown up. He was a major." So apparently he hadn't... And on reflection, it seems to me pretty obvious what happened, that he would go back. He was obviously... His nerves were gone and shot. He was finished. And he would go back, and he would see the MO, and the MO would say, "Okay, back you go." And he would be treated as a casualty. But if it had been somebody in the ranks, there'd have been no such treatment as, you know, as indeed happened to me. I got 3 years for doing something a good deal less. I'm not blaming him at all, but I am pointing to the injustice of it, I think.
Difference between treatment of officer and...
Exactly,
other.
Exactly, yes.
Coming back to the artillery bombardment before Alamein, this has become something almost of a legend in military history.
Yeah.
Do you think it deserves its reputation?
Oh, I suppose so, yes. I know nothing about the sort of military... you know, as I say, when you're in action, you have no idea what's happening. I'm always struck by, when I watch war movies, films, how everything seems to be choreographed, and you know exactly where the enemy is, and you can see the goodies sort of moving in, and you can see who is doing what to whom, and so on. In my experience, battle was never like that. You haven't the foggiest idea where you are, where the enemy is, what is happening, or anything else. It is just one almighty confusion and shambles, and so as you know, I mean, I'm quite sure that the people at home reading their morning paper know more about the sort of strategic and tactical situation and the people involved in the fighting. I only assume that somebody, somebody knows something about it. One hopes so, anyway, that your officers might know something about what's happening. But you, the ordinary soldier in the ranks, have no idea what's going on at all. And it's extremely rare to see the enemy. Very, very rare indeed.
Now, as somebody who has been in combat yourself, when you read books about combat, I'm thinking in particular of Olivia Manning's books,
yes,
about North Africa in her trilogy, do you feel that books of that kind adequately convey what it's like to be in combat?
I think she had a very good shot at it, actually. I think she did very well, considering, she would have no first-hand experience, and I think she'd done a good deal of conscientious research and talked to people and read a lot about it, and I think she did a fair job. On the whole, I don't think I think probably the only people who can do it effectively are people who have actually been into action, and even then it's extremely difficult to do it, to convey all the sort of multiplicity and confusion of response is very difficult to do. I can recall a book, for instance, by a woman, now this is another woman's novel, but which about the First World War, a novelist called Susan Hill wrote a book called, I think she called it something like Strange Meeting, or I think she actually used that title from the Wilfred Owen poem. But it was set in the trenches, and it was kind of David and Jonathan relationship of two young officers in the trenches. And it really wasn't very good. And not only had obviously she'd read, I suppose, a fair amount of the literature of the First World War to get the atmosphere and details, but she got things wrong. Technically, she got things wrong, which were quite glaring. And this wasn't, I felt that it wasn't entirely her fault, that somebody, I don't know, should have read the proofs and somebody who knew a bit about the First World War, and possibly somebody who'd been in it might have been a good idea, at least somebody, a military historian or something, because she actually got things quite wrong. I mean, so glaringly wrong. I can remember, for instance, there was a barrage of Lewis guns, which sort of light machine guns, these are. So she obviously thought they were sort of heavy artillery, Lewis guns, and things like that. It's so easy to go wrong, I think. That's why Olivia Manning did such a good job. There was no glaring errors in the thing. One of the best accounts, I think, of the Desert War is Keith Douglas's book called Alamein to Zemzem. He was in the tanks. It's very much about tank warfare. It's an actual factual account of that part of the campaign, written under not ideal circumstances at all, in great haste, when he was wounded and he was in hospital and convalescing. Is when he read this. I don't know. Have you read? Not read.
No.
That is an excellent account of action.
Could I ask you again about your attitude towards the German enemy? Because I did ask you this in relation to the declaration of war in 1939. Yeah. By the time you got into combat, what was your attitude towards the Germans? Had it changed?
No, I don't think so. I think. Well, yes, I suppose it had. I think that... as far as one thought about them at all, it was in a curiously detached sort of way. They were the enemy, and they were almost an extension of their arms, in a sense. I mean, they were threatening, And there was something a bit frightening about the Germans too, because they always seemed to me, and still do, looking back, they seemed to me more efficient as soldiers than the British. This might be a sort of, you know, a private sort of projection, and I might be doing the British soldiers the grave injustice of assuming they're all like me. But I mean, in Normandy, this is a bit of a jump. For instance, I can remember the way in which the Germans fought, although they were on the losing end of things, they fought with a kind of tenacity and courage that was, I should have thought, fairly rare among our lot. The snipers, for example, they used to get up trees in Normandy, you know, sort of fairly rural sort of landscape there, with lots of wood of the bocage, and the snipers would conceal themselves, camouflage with sort of leaves and greenery and stuff on, you know, and get up trees and snipe from up trees. Now, and they were a great menace, but they would snipe away and stay there until they'd been spotted, and sooner or later they would be seen, and they'd spray the trees with, you know, Bren or Sten gun or something, and they'd come tumbling out. I feel that a British soldier, if he was in the same position, sort of put that there to snipe, if there was some chance of him being detected, would be right. Again, I may be unfair. I'm probably talking about what I would do. I'd be rather reluctant to give my position away, and think self-preservation would come first with me. Whereas they seemed quite willing. They seemed prepared to die, which to me is an astounding thing. I don't think any cause is worth dying for.
But did that make you and your comrades respect them or despise them?
Respect them and fear them, I think. Yes, I think on the whole there was a good deal of respect. And if perhaps, I don't know, you know, if a dear friend or something, somebody had been... they're not even that, you see, because friends of mine were killed, and a particular friend of mine was killed. I didn't feel any special animosity towards the Germans. I think the hatred and animosity was to the condition of war itself. I hated war. I don't think I hated the Germans particularly. I feared them, certainly, and still do, in a way. It's a sort of, and I think they're a frightening race. I think that curious mixture, which seems to me a particular Germanic thing, is a mixture of brutality and sentimentality. And also sort of mad bravery, too.
But did you also have the sense that they were too predictable as soldiers?
I wouldn't know about that, no. I mean that's the idea. I suppose that could probably be argued. But about the I don't know what was predictable and what wasn't. I mean, they just seemed to be extraordinarily brave and efficient soldiers. And I'm convinced that on equal terms, they'd have wiped the floor with us. I'm pretty sure of that, actually. I don't know. Again, I'm talking now about the sort of... This is the post-war sort of view of things from what one has read and so on. But it does seem to me that if Hitler hadn't made the mistake of invading Russia, if we hadn't had Russia, in fact, as allies, and let's say, I rather think the Germans would have been victors. Really. I don't know. I mean, I really don't know about these things. It's just a feeling.
In this respect, one thing that struck me in your book, The Argument of Kings, was you're leaving the safety catch on. One did wonder, actually, when you read that, whether it was some kind of Freudian slip.
Well, I mean, that is perfectly possible. I certainly had no wish to kill anybody. There's no doubt about that. And as far as I know, I never did kill anybody, and I'm extremely pleased to be able to say that. I can remember one of my sons, when he was very small, asking me about, said, "Did you kill any Germans?" And I said, "No, I didn't, thank God, not to my knowledge." And he was really rather disappointed, I could see that, but he would have much rather, I'm sure, that I'd have said, "Yes, I killed 55 Germans," and I certainly didn't, and I had no wish to. And I mean, that possible, the Freudian thing of subconsciously or whatever, is a possibility. I think it's just incompetence, and you know, because I'm totally incompetent and with mechanical things, and I just forgot, I think. But it's possible, I suppose.
Could I also ask you about the question of your attitudes then towards Britain? I'm talking about patriotism. Somebody from your social background, did you feel that you had a stake in the country? Did you feel patriotic?
No. I didn't think in those terms at all. But if anything, no. If anything, the reverse, really. I hadn't at that time any political views at all, absolutely no political affiliations or views, because of this quite shocking ignorance. I was totally ignorant of such things. I'd no idea what Nazism was, and so on. I think a lot of people forget this. Actually, they assume that that young people in the Second World War were aware of the Nazi menace and so forth. Now, things like the concentration camps were not known. There was no knowledge I'm quite sure, you know, people in authority, people in the government, for instance, certainly knew something about the existence of concentration camps. But the general public had no idea, and a great deal of what rumours were filtering through was discounted anyway as propaganda, because on both sides there was a great deal of propaganda, so one didn't know. The realisation of what had been happening in Germany, in the camps, only came at the end of the war, when the Allies moved in and actually saw, and then the newsreel shots came through. So one knew nothing about that during the war. You weren't fighting this evil of Nazi fascism. I wasn't, anyway. I knew nothing about it. I was totally ignorant.
So you didn't feel that we had something in Britain that was specially worth defending?
I didn't, no. I didn't. Whether other people did, I wouldn't know about that. But I certainly didn't know. If anything, I mean, if there was anything at all, and this might be a sort of rationalising after the event, but if anything, I felt that I was the one of the generation who were the sons of the people who fought in the First World War, who had been promised a land fit for heroes by Lloyd George. And what had they come back to? The general strike, hunger marches, and unemployment, and so on. This has always been my view of the Second World War, that we weren't, unlike the First World War, where you had this tremendous excitement and euphoria when war was declared. I'm sure you read about this in the poems and so on of Rupert Brooke, where he says, "The swimmers into cleanness leaping," you know, sort of a great adventure this was going to be, which was fairly quickly followed by appalling disillusionment and misery, and when the realization of what they were going into was not a cleansing spiritual adventure, but a long, slogging, desperately wretched war of attrition and with appalling casualties and heartless politicians and brass hats, so actually protracting a war that needn't have been protracted. And this was Sassoon's view, wasn't it, in 1916, that peace could have been negotiated. And it was the politicians who were keeping it going. That seemed to me that war was a war of excitement, idealism, of adventure, of almost the kind of spiritual cleansing, but followed by appalling disillusionment, and then the great sad tragedy of a whole generation, really, sort of the best being killed. The Second World War wasn't like that, I don't think. I think, in the main, it seemed to me that while I, at the age of, I think, what was I, 18, when I went into the army, well, I was just a silly boy. It was exciting, privately, personal adventure for me, but not on a national scale. And I had no real understanding, but I think those people who were a little older than I was, so just a few years older, young married men and so on, who's with perhaps children were being called up. Now, their attitude was certainly not one of swimmers and cleaners leaping. It was a dour resignation to the inevitability of Christ. They were being called up, in they were going. And it was a kind of gloomy, sour, resigned. And this seemed to me the attitude, on the whole, of the British Army. They were browned off. That was the phrase they used. Everybody was browned off. It was a browned off army, in fact. This, I'm talking the ranks now. The officers might have been different. We know one suspects they were. But that seemed to be the general impression. And the poet who gets it for me of the Second World War is a man called Henry Reed. I don't know whether you've read his poems called Lessons of the War. There's a famous one called Naming of Parts, where all the recruits are doing their naming of the parts of the rifle of the Lee Enfield 303. And there's this poor recruit there, a civilian in uniform. And part of his mind, you know, the sergeant, the weapon instructor, is talking about the various parts, the sling and the swivel and the bolt and the action. And the recruit is, he says, this is the bolt, we ease it back rapidly backwards and forwards. And then he says, and the bees in the garden move rapidly backwards and forwards. A kind of sad, resigned feeling that he shouldn't be here, yet it's inevitable, it's what he's got to do. And you discharge your duties as best as you're able. But not with any enthusiasm or excitement or dedication. And certainly no patriotic fervour. The kind of patriotism that one came across, real patriotism, I think of Edward Thomas, another great poet who was killed in the First World War. He was walking through somewhere in England, the countryside, with a woman called Eleanor Fudge, and she records this in a very fine book called The Last 4 Years. And she said, "Why are you going, Edward, to the war?" He'd volunteered. He was well over age. He was pushing 40, getting on for 40. Grey-haired, but he nevertheless volunteered to go. And in fact, he went and was killed. Now, she said, why are you going? What are you fighting for? Because she was a bit sceptical about the sort of jingoistic attitudes and so on. And he bent down and picked up a handful of the soil. And he said, quite literally for this, the English soil. Now, that's the kind of patriotism which I understand and respect and so on, but I certainly didn't feel. I might now, as a more mature person, I might think this country, I do feel that this country probably, with all its faults, it might be worth defending in that way, perhaps to the death, but I certainly didn't then.
I was struck in the argument of King's about one of your comrades who was trying to blame war on capitalism, as I recollect, and your response to him, and you said, I think I'm right in saying, in your reconstruction of the dialogue, that no, the well-off suffer as well in the war.
Well, that's true, isn't it? I mean, I almost reluctantly I say it, but I mean, they certainly do. They don't suffer perhaps quite as much, I think. It did seem to me another kind of injustice. I do recall officers having their flasks and so on and having a nip. Now, there's another interesting thing. I never had a rum ration in the war. Somehow it never seemed to get to me. I've heard and read about other people getting rum rations, but I never saw any rum.
So you felt that there was sacrifice but inequality of sacrifice?
I think there was. I think officers had a cozier time. I mean, in action, it is a great leveller, of course. I can remember, for example, in North Africa, I was digging in. You shared a slit trench in the infantry. You had two of you.